Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
While the Jets and Sharks were playing it cool, Leonard Bernstein was in hot water with the FBI. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today we look at the tumultuous political life of the late composer. Also, Argentine actress-turned-singer-songwriter Juana Molina plays live in our studio. To begin, though, the revival of West Side Story that's doing so well at the box office on Broadway has been described as a sweet and affectionate version of the classic gang tale. But when Leonard Bernstein was at work on the show, on the score, he was the subject of some sharp controversy. Throughout much of his career, the FBI kept a large dossier on the composer and conductor. He was blacklisted by the State Department and had his passport taken away for a time. His political activities continued right up until his death in 1990, and according to a new book, they had a much deeper impact on his music than is often thought. The book is called Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician, and its author, Barry Seldes, joins us in our studio. Barry, welcome.
Hi, John. Thank you.
Lots of people love West Side Story.
Yes.
Love the legacy, the musical legacy of Leonard Bernstein. Why would those same people need to know or care about his political work?
Well, Bernstein had a very, very deep and long-standing left-wing political life that goes all the way back to the 1930s. And although it was known that there was some politics in Bernstein's life, the full extent of it wasn't really available or aware to any of us until the FBI released its dossier on him to the Southern California American Civil Liberties Union. When I read of that, I got hold of that and read those hundreds and hundreds of pages.
Now, you're a poli-sci professor.
I am indeed.
Not a music composition or theory professor.
That's
so you're coming at this from that angle. Were you a fan first?
Bernstein was a presence in my life. I grew up in New York, and there he was. And when he took ill and died, it was a shock. So, indeed.
All right. So then to kind of circle back to my initial question, when you got a chance to see what was in that dossier, did it change what you thought, what you heard in Bernstein's music?
It certainly gave me a much greater understanding of Bernstein's political life. And now, with the release at the same time, or a couple of years later, of the correspondence and papers that the Bernstein family gave over to the Library of Congress, I found a plethora, a wealth of material that opened up a whole new dimension on this man's life and his music.
So did his political leanings, which were, as you say, to the left,
yes,
especially during the 1950s, Cold War, McCarthy, was that a kind of a drag on his career?
Well, I think that we have to go back to the 40s where this business really begins to take place. What happened was, in fact, if we can go back to the 30s, when he was a student at Harvard, in the air was the idea, and I think it was promoted by Sessions, the composer Roger Sessions.
Roger Sessions, yeah.
That an American opera or any American piece has got to be able to take account of the social forces that were dividing the country. And, of course, at that time, the great literature, Ben Shahn as a photographer, so many others in the different arts, were very much aware of that and were writing very compelling works based upon the political, social forces operant on American life at the time.
Well, the country was coming out of the Great Depression.
That's
correct. And you know, those kinds of social issues would have been a part of the culture as well.
Exactly. Furthermore, Bernstein had a professor of aesthetics, David Prell, who promoted the idea that art must have a social ethic attached to it. So I think Bernstein took all of this and founded his life and his works upon these themes of social ethic and art being together, that one aids the other in development.
Now, we don't think of something like West Side Story as a political work, but it is a social work in a sense.
That, it is indeed a social work, but it wasn't quite the work that he wanted to compose in the end. He wanted to go much more profoundly into the social fabric of American life. What happened was that in 1939, he conducted at Harvard Mark Blitzstein's Cradle Will Rock, which, of course, was the New Deal, left-wing New Deal folk opera. In 1948, 10 years later, with the Cold War on, Bernstein led a revival of West Side Story, of Cradle Will Rock. And to do that in those days was to announce to the world that he's taking a stand. He was doing this at the very moment that the Henry Wallace was mounting a campaign against Truman and Dewey to restore the New Deal. So Bernstein was going to write a new political work. He was very, very much into writing that work. Progressives lost to Truman in 1948, and the blacklist soon hit Bernstein. And for the next, 6, 7 years, he had to hide, as it were, take an inward migration until the blacklist was taken from him and he was able to get back into the good graces of the orthodoxy.
Now, he was blacklisted for what, being a communist?
For belonging to and speaking on behalf of what turned out to be communist fronts or so labeled by the Attorney General.
Was he a communist?
No. He was never a member of the Communist Party, no. But many of the organizations that he had belonged to or associated with were doing good works here on the American scene, aiding in civil rights, civil liberties, and the like. But, of course, in those days, anything of that stripe was branded communist.
As you say, the FBI dossier on Leonard Bernstein has become part of the public record through the,
yes.
You know, these things of their 50 years or however long they were supposed to be secret has expired, Freedom of Information Act. And getting a chance to look at some of this stuff, the list of organizations that Bernstein was associated with, there's, if I'm remembering correctly, the American Association for Yugoslav Relief. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems really kind of, there's nothing there. And there's even a little scribbling on the margins by J. Edgar Hoover saying, to the effect, there's nothing there, I can't take this to the White House. A young Negro student association, something like that. Would these have been buzzwords, catchwords that somebody was looking for?
Absolutely. And some of them were communist fronts, sure.
Would he have known that?
Maybe, maybe not. Because in those days, in the 40s, remember, the Soviet Union had been our ally during the war. And therefore, communism didn't quite have, for so many Americans on the left in those days, the negative connotation it would have once Stalinism was really revealed to us all. So I think that Bernstein, for a while, like so many others, Arthur Miller, Norman Mailer, so many other, Albert Einstein, thought that the anti-communist crusade was really an attempt to wreck the New Deal, which a lot of it was. That was McCarthy's aim, to wreck the New Deal.
We're speaking with Barry Seldes. His book is called Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician. So you say West Side Story was not the political work that Bernstein would have wanted to write. He never really did. I mean, you write that on his deathbed, he
right.
laments the fact that he never got to write the great American work in that Roger Sessions mode that you're talking about, where it reflects the political and social realities of the country.
That's right. That's right.
Why was that?
Well, because the American electorate, which had been at one time in the Roosevelt camp, had moved to the right, so much of it, and had disintegrated. And he was looking for a way, a libretto, upon which he could write a work that would restore to everyone's good senses where they ought to go. Very utopian idea. But as the blue-collar and middle-class parts of the old Roosevelt coalition had moved into the right, the Democratic Party going with it, Bernstein was left marginalized and could never, in those last 20 years when he was hunting for the libretto, couldn't come up with it. They tried a number of things. None of them worked out.
What about Candide? I mean, I know that's sort of earlier in his career.
56.
But, you know, if you look for it, if in, you know, hindsight, you know there's a political subtext, you can find elements of it, right?
Right. Lillian Hellman, who had herself appeared before the Committee on Un-American Activities, and Bernstein had gotten together in the 50s. And by 1956, once he was off the blacklist, and he had, I think by this time, got the telegram from the Philharmonic that he'll back as guest conductor, they were going to do Candide. And the intention was to use the Grand Inquisitor scene as a way to strike back at the McCarthyites. However, by the time they finished writing, first what Hellman wrote was not set to music by Bernstein, and secondly, it was tepid. Of course, Candide was a lot of fun, but it did not have that impact that Bernstein might have wanted to create at the time and later.
It's fun to sort of dig through the archaeology of Leonard Bernstein's music. West Side Story doesn't have a Jewish gang, but that was his initial idea.
Right.
So you still hear the shofar calls, da-da-da-da, you know, which are dotted through the score. And here in Candide, what might have been a politically wrenching inquisitor scene turns into something that has just the vaguest whiff of that.
Right.
This pernicious limb of Satan denied the existence of original sin.
No!
Hang him!
Hang him!
Oh, no. Can it be? My beloved master.
Ladies and gentlemen, one final word. God, in his wisdom, made it possible to invent the rope. And what is a rope for but to create a noose? And glory be, what is a noose for but... ooh.
What a lovely day, what a jolly day, what a day for a holiday. What a lovely, lovely, jolly, jolly day for a holiday. What a lovely, lovely, jolly, jolly day for a holiday.
A little bit from Leonard Bernstein's Candide from Act One, and Barry Seldes, author of Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician. At the beginning of that little clip, there is perhaps a vague echo of, you know, what he might have originally had in mind. And then by the end of even this short clip, it's like, what a happy day.
Right. Dissipates away.
So you say that he was on the blacklist, and by this point he was off the blacklist and was back in good graces with the New York Philharmonic. How did he do that?
Well, to go back, in 1950, he was blacklisted by first the State Department and then CBS. CBS had a very close relationship with the Philharmonic, and there's no smoking gun, so to speak, but to say this, the close relationship was such that members of CBS sat on the board of the Philharmonic, and once Bernstein was blacklisted by CBS, he was very much afraid that he'd be blacklisted by the Philharmonic. And therefore, at the end of the 50-51 season, when his contract expired, he fled. He literally fled the country, went to Cuernavaca, Mexico, where he met with a number of blacklisted Hollywood people who had fled and got into exile there. How he got back on was this, that by 1953, he found out that his passport was revoked. Now, that could have killed his conducting career completely, because as did happen to Paul Robeson, so it could have happened to Bernstein. He hired some attorneys.
For the simple reason that you can't travel to Europe and play in, you know, Rome or Paris or Milan.
Right, right. So he was afraid he couldn't conduct here, although he had a couple of gigs, but nothing with the Philharmonic, and he could not travel. If that happened, it could wreck his career indeed. So he got himself an attorney who had been part of the right-wing. Yeah, he hired this fellow who knew the ropes.
Uh-huh.
He was told...
Keep your friends close and your enemies closer, huh?
Right, indeed. So he had to sign a very humiliating affidavit that he had never been a member of the Communist Party, that he was a good Jewish boy, went to the synagogue, voted only for Democrats and Republicans, forswore all of his previous allegiances and alliances. He was naive. He apologized. That affidavit was going to be kept secret except to be sent to the various vigilante groups which would clear him. And they did. So he got cleared and he could now write for the Hollywood machinery. Of course, he soon did that. In short order, Robert Sudeck of the Ford Foundation got Bernstein to appear on Omnibus by telling CBS, if the sponsors won't pay you, Ford Foundation will, and Ford had huge amounts of money.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, CBS said, sure, we're going to get our money. We don't care.
But he'd been off the blacklist.
He'd signed the
affidavit. So.
Well, that was in order to get off the blacklist, he signed the affidavit.
Right.
He was off the blacklist in Hollywood, now off the blacklist with CBS. And once that happened, he was off the blacklist. And now the Philharmonic could go ahead and...
Okay, so it was a combination of signing this very embarrassing document, this affidavit.
Had it been revealed to Moore, sure, yes.
And a little bit of money, maybe a lot of bit of money, thrown at CBS's feet
by the Ford Foundation. Yeah.
Okay. The book is called Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician. We're speaking with the author, Barry Seldes.
Check out today's Soundcheck blog.
There's a backhanded compliment in all of this. The FBI cared about Leonard Bernstein because the American people cared about him. classical music world just hasn't had that sort of visibility since. If John Corigliano revealed that his soundtrack to the film The Red Violin was actually a coded communist message, do you think anyone would care?
For the rest of the story, visit the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org.
I'm being only slightly cynical and facetious in today's blog, but Barry, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, was it unusual for a classical music figure to attract this sort of attention? Was it just Bernstein?
No. Aaron Copland. Aaron Copland was himself barred from appearances, and most egregious. I forget which of his pieces was going to be played at Eisenhower's inauguration, and it was suddenly thrown out. So a number of others were blacklisted this way by the State Department and by others and by Eisenhower. So no, right, Bernstein was not alone. Maybe the most famous, but not alone.
So is there a cautionary tale here for contemporary musicians of whatever stripe? I mean, you know, could someone, I mean, I'm trying to think who we even have who approaches the visibility of Leonard Bernstein in the classical music world. Maybe Yo-Yo Ma, you know, who has appeared before Congress but as a kind of a friendly witness.
Right.
But, I mean, is there something in the tale of Leonard Bernstein that we shouldn't forget?
First of all, the fact that so much of our art is politically inspired and has been increasingly so since the 70s, I think that's a very, very good sign. I think that today nobody would question that. However, you know, the wheel turns, and for all we know, a reaction could set in again. The social forces for that possibility are with us. And without going much further into that, I would say we all have to be careful. But yes, indeed, artists are among the forefront of those expressing what is on our minds, what bothers us, and more power to them.
Although we don't normally think of our classical artists as expressing that.
Well, you know, John Adams.
John Adams. But
Corigliano.
But, you know, you think of the protest singers of the 60s and you think of, you know, you think of Phil Oakes and Bob Dylan. You don't necessarily think of Elliot Carter or indeed Leonard Bernstein. However, you know, Bernstein did have a close association with JFK.
Right.
And when Kennedy died, that was the inspiration for the Kaddish Symphony, wasn't it?
He had started it. In fact, I think, yeah, he had already had it underway. And basically what it was a work directed against atom bombs and fire bombings, et cetera. Yeah. And it's a kind of, it's called Kaddish. There is a kind of dialogue with God, or at least a talk to God about why have you allowed this to happen. But in the end, Bernstein is arguing that it's we, the people, who must take power into our own hands and prevent this kind of thing from ever happening again.
This is a little bit from that symphony by Leonard Bernstein, the Kaddish. And it's actually the third of the Bernstein symphonies. Bernstein's Kaddish is Symphony No. 3, and in a moment, more about the political life of Leonard Bernstein. And coming up a little bit later, Juana Molina started her career as a TV actress. Now this Argentinian is one of the most innovative singer-songwriters in Latin America. She'll join us to play live here in our Soundcheck studio. Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and this year has seen three new recordings of Leonard Bernstein's sensational theater work, Mass. But while it's gaining popularity today, back in 1971, it scared the Nixon administration. That story is recounted in the new book, Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician, Author Barry Seldes is with us on Soundcheck today. Barry, Mass was many things. It's kind of a musical mishmash of different styles and stuff. It was commissioned for the opening of the Kennedy Center. Big event. Great opportunity for the president to be seen, you know, and the FBI tells him, steer clear. Why?
Yeah, great story. We have to go back to the year before when the radical priest Daniel Berrigan had been finally caught. He was on the lam, and he was incarcerated in Danbury, Connecticut, the penitentiary. Bernstein was searching for...
And his brother, too, right?
And Philip, indeed. Daniel was... an author of plays, Catonsville Nine. Bernstein had gone to see it and was very much taken by Berrigan, who was a man who had stood up to the powers that be and was now in jail. So Bernstein's ethical side saw resonance in Berrigan and thought that maybe Berrigan could be the commanding presence in this new work. He visited Berrigan in penitentiary, and Berrigan put him onto a sermon that Berrigan had written about how one must stand up indeed. And Bernstein was very much taken with this. As the work was progressing, and as they were going through the rehearsals, there was a bit of fun going on that Bernstein was going to stick into the libretto, for the first night at least, a remark directed at Nixon, who would be showing up. The FBI already was worried about the very fact that Bernstein had gone to see Berrigan. They had canceled further visits. The FBI was also under stress because the Pentagon Papers had been released, and they couldn't control that. So now they were very worried, real paranoia on top of the paranoia.
The Pentagon Papers have been released, and they're worrying about a classical composer.
Who might scream some kind of derogatory remark at Nixon and embarrass him. So in the end, Nixon doesn't show up. And, of course, the remark was not there at all. Bernstein never intended to do that because he would have embarrassed Jackie Kennedy, who was, to him, not only a great woman, but married to the man who had done so much for him. There was no way that Bernstein was going to do that. But Nixon, indeed, in his own paranoia, decided not to show up that night.
So even after signing this humiliating affidavit that you told us about before that got Bernstein off the blacklist, the FBI still shadowed him through the rest of his career to the point that they actually get wind of what might or might not be planned during rehearsals for a new piece that he's writing.
Right. Hoover never accepted the affidavit. See, when you sign an affidavit, you're swearing something. He was sure Bernstein was a communist, and therefore he wanted to get him on perjury charges and looked for every possible way to do that, and finally was told by the Attorney General's office, there's no way, just drop it. But Hoover was humiliated, and now, in 1970-71, he had an opportunity to get this guy and try it again. He was dead within a year, Hoover, but to his dying day, sought to get Bernstein indicted for perjury.
So Leonard Bernstein goes ahead and writes the piece Mass. It is played at the opening of the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., and the papers duly report on it and on the hullabaloo that occurs afterwards, you know, where people are applauding and Bernstein is meeting and greeting. And in the White House, the tapes exist of H.R. Haldeman, the chief of staff, talking to Richard Nixon about the Time magazine article, which has all these photos of Leonard Bernstein, you know, kissing people. This is the tape.
But they also have a whole strip of pictures of Bernstein kissing everybody he could find. And he's kissing a lot of men on the mouth, you know, right, including the big black guy. Like this Alvin Ailey, that has an answer. You know, men kissing men is not... I heard of that world, but
there are very few things that you can clearly get. Absolutely sickening is pretty clear. That's Richard Nixon's reaction to H.R. Haldeman describing these photos of Leonard Bernstein kissing people on the mouth. And Haldeman goes on to say a lot of them are men, including the big black guy, by whom he means Alvin Ailey, the great choreographer. It's just the Pentagon Papers are out there. Yeah. The whole House of Cards is beginning to crumble, and here they are talking about Bernstein.
Right. Well, Nixon, of course, was paranoid to begin with, increasingly so, and of course it became so much so obvious as the cracks and fissures opened up in a couple of years, just 2 or 3 years later, and he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
But yes.
He sort of gives the ultimate kiss off to Bernstein at the end of these tapes, where he just calls him a son of a bitch. I mean, it's something about this guy, and he talks about, that's a Jewish sounding name. I mean, how much of that played? There were early intimations of homosexuality. How much would these things have played into the FBI's interest in him?
Well, it's interesting that in none of the FBI files, hundreds and hundreds of pages, is there anything about Bernstein's homosexuality. The FBI just, for some reason, was not going after Bernstein on that score. So far as I know, there's nothing that would say that Hoover was after him on that. Of course, there are other stories about Hoover himself,
leaving
that to the side. None of that, I don't think, shows up anywhere, except, of course, in these tapes. No, it was Bernstein's politics. It was Bernstein's politics that was getting him in trouble with the FBI. It was that that got him blacklisted.
Well, so he gets off the blacklist, and he continues to try and express himself in music. Songfest, originally commissioned for the bicentennial year, is an example. But as you write, on his deathbed, still this kind of great regret that he never got to do it. It sounds like such a great thing to try and make your music reflect your political and your social beliefs. Was it, in fact, a kind of a millstone around his neck? Did it, in the end, really dilute the effect of his music?
Well, right on his deathbed, he was saying to, he wrote to Harry Kraut, his manager, that he hopes that he has not hurt anybody. And then he says, my great regret, I've not written that important piece. Songfest, which was 1977, Bernstein dies in 1990, 13 years earlier, he had, when writing Songfest for the Bicentennial, was a year late, called it first, subtitled Notes for an American Opera. It starts out with quoting from a Frank O'Hara poem, Let Us Do Something Un-American. Of course, that heralds back to the Un-American Activities Committee, and sets up the whole piece that way. Furthermore, there's a fanfare which is off-putting, hardly a bicentenary celebration. Some of the poems selected, To What You Said, which
is this Walt Whitman setting that we're right. hearing now.
Right.
This had just been uncovered at that time.
Well, the poem had never gone into leaves of grass.
Well, the story, there's 13 years between this piece and his death, but the full story is recounted by my guest, Barry Seldes, in the book Leonard Bernstein, The Political Life of an American Musician. And it is a really interesting point of view on a story that we thought we all knew. Barry, thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us today.
My pleasure, John. Thank you.
That new American salute.
Still to come on our program, Argentine singer-songwriter Juana Molina plays live in our studio. And tune in tomorrow when the pianist Emmanuel Axe joins us to talk about the state of classical music and a new collaboration with choreographer Mark Morris. That's tomorrow on Soundcheck.